The topics of Parshas Va'alostecha are many and varied. Having gotten used through the course of Parshas Bamidbar and Noso to many numbers, there is this week a deluge of episodes and of themes. And the Parsha begins, of course, with the menorah. Perek Ches, Pasuk Beis. Daber el Aaron va'amar toilav. Beha'alosecho es haneros. The lighting of the menorah. And this, as we note, is actually the third time in the Torah that there is a presentation, a reference to the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. None of the other appurtenances of the Mishkan have so many repetitions. But we've had Hadlokas Haner in Parshas Tetzaveh, and again in Chumash Vayikra in Parshas Emor, and for here the third time in the beginning of Parshas Va'alostecha. And Rashi famously comments on the Torah's usage of the word Baha'alosecha es Haneros. Of course, in our practical translation, we refer to that as lighting the menorah. But the word for lighting is lahadlik. Beha'alosecha es haneros, to raise the neros, seems to carry with it a further connotation. And Rashi comments from Chazal, beha'alosecha means that when the Kohen, or whoever it is who lights the menorah and holds the shamash to the light, to the lamp, he needs to keep it there, ad shetehei shashalheves ola me'eleha, until the flame of the lamp that is receiving rises up by itself. As we know, it's possible to hold the shamash, and it kind of catches, but it doesn't really look like it's going to catch until moments afterwards. One needs to keep the shamash there until you can see that the light itself is going up. That's Beha'alosecha. What is the meaning behind this requirement? On the face of it, it seems to be, and I would use the term advisedly, no more than a hidur mitzvah. That is to say, that's the way to light. Not in a hurried fashion, but rather give each light its due attention. But Ramosha Feinstein, very interestingly, gives us a further insight into this aspect of the mitzvah, to keep the shamash by the lamp until the light goes up by itself. In the beginning of Pirkei Avos, we're told it's one of the first injunctions that we have from the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Heim Amru Shlosha Devarim. One of the three things that we have from the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, firstly, is Hevi Mesunim Badin, to be deliberate in judgment. And then, V'ha'amidu Tamidim Harbe. Ha'amidu Tamidim Harbe. The English translation, I believe, would be, raise up many Talmidim. I think this is a good example of that which is so often the case, that the English translation can never do full justice to what the Mishnah is saying. Because when you talk about raising something up, often if it is an inanimate object and you raised it up, if you remove your hand, it will fall. The Tosfos Yom Tov, in his commentary to the Mishnah there, explains that the word leha'amid, as we know, is the causative of omeid. If omeid means to stand, then leha'amid means to allow to stand. But ultimately what that means is, when you allow something to stand, then once you withdraw, it will remain standing. Otherwise you are not ma'amid. And the point is, says the Tosfos Yom Tov, is that the goal of education, the goal of imparting Torah, is a process that is not complete until, when the teacher withdraws, the Talmud can stand by himself. It is not only to impart information, where the Talmud will never really know what to do in any given situation until he turns back to the teacher, but rather to impart a method, to impart an approach, whereby, after a while, the Talmud himself is omeid. He can stand on his own two feet. At that point, Chinuch is complete. So ha'amidu tamidim harbe is to equip the Talmud with the ability to stand for himself. As Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was known to remark, the definition of a Talmid is not someone who can tell you everything the Rebbe said. That's a meturgeman, or in our terminology, a tape recorder. If he can recall everything the Rebbe said, that doesn't make him a Talmud. It just means that he's been listening very carefully to facts. The definition of a Talmud, says Reb Chaim, is someone who can tell you what the Rebbe would say on any given question, which did not perhaps itself come up, but he's absorbed the methodology, he's absorbed the approach. That's a Talmud. How would the Rebbe approach this question? How would he respond to this inquiry? And that is how Midu Tamidim Harbe. Reb Moshe Feinstein explains that this is the concept that is alluded to in Baha'alosecha Es HaNeiros. As we know, the menorah, a symbol of Torah, and the kindling of a flame is really the notion of imparting Torah knowledge. The shamash, who kindles the other lamps, he's the Rebbe, he's the teacher. And now the question is, what defines successful Torah teaching? And to that, Rashi tells us, the job is not complete. Ad shetehei hashalheves olam me'elah. The teacher flame stands by the Talmud flame until the flame of the Talmud goes up by itself, and then the teacher can move on. And this is certainly always important, all the more so in our times, where more and more quantities are replacing and masquerading as qualities, and the notion of education as imparting methodology is certainly receding unless due attention is paid to it. So that's a very timely and important message from the opening of Baha'alosecha Es HaNeiros. As the parasha continues, we have the section of separating the Levim and preparing them for the Avodah. And that's really straight after these opening psukim from Pasuk Hei and Pasuk Vav, Kachas HaLevim, Mitoch B'nei Yisrael, V'tihata Osam. And interestingly, there is a basic question that is raised by the Rishonim, it's discussed by the Ramban, and that is, when are we to understand that this procedure took place? When was the sanctification, and when was the preparation of the Levim for Avodah? The Ramban's approach is that this happened in Chodesh Iyar, in the second month of the second year. And the reason why that's noteworthy is because it raises a very interesting question as to how to understand all of the order of events from the beginning of Bamidbar until now. The background, of course, is that we know that the first event mentioned in Parshas Bamidbar happened at the beginning of Chodesh Iyar, the counting of Bnei Yisrael, Ba'echad B'Chodesh Hasheni. That said, there are other events, certainly that are mentioned later on, specifically in the beginning of Perek Tes, which happened earlier to that, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. The section of Korban Pesach, which ultimately becomes Pesach Sheni, and the Torah tells us that happened in the first month of Nisan. So we know that if we have our 2 points of definicy, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, it's Rosh Chodesh Iyar. In Perek Tes, it's a month earlier, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And now the question is, what about all of the events between Perek Aleph and Perek Tes? When did they happen? Which is the anomaly? Or which sets the tone? Which is the default understanding as to when these events occurred? And clearly, as far as the Ramban is concerned, and we know this is often the case for the Ramban, he is reluctant ever to use the concept of Ein Mukdama Me'ucher Batorah unless it is absolutely unavoidable. As far as the Ramban is concerned, if the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar is time-stamped as the beginning of Iyar, and everything is to be taken as happening around about that time, unless you are forced to conclude otherwise, unless the Torah itself says so. The Chanukah Sanesim at the end of Parshas Noso, we know happened on the day that the Mishkan was opened, and that is also in Nisan. But without definite or specific information to the contrary, these events happened, taking their cue from the beginning of the Chumash Bamidbar, in Chodesh Iyar. Now, the reason why this is very noteworthy is because the Ramban, it seems, will leave us with a bit of a question. Namely, if the Levim are only prepared for Avodah in Chodesh Iyar, well, we know that the Mishkan is functioning already for a month. The Chanukas HaMishkan was on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And that being the case, who did the job of the Levim for the first month? After all, the Levim have their role. They are the Mishorerim, and they are a part and parcel of the Avodah of the Mishkan. If they are only dedicated for the Avodah in month number two, so who has been doing the job of the Levim for month number one? And we should be aware that it is for this reason, not that the Ramban, in terms of Parshanot, is bound by it, but the Gemara itself discusses the timing of this preparation of the Levim. The Gemara says in Maseches Gittin, Daf Samach Amud Aleph, there were 8 sections of Torah that were said on the day that the Mishkan was set up. Shmona Parshios Ne'emru Bo Bayom. And one of them was the Parsha of the Levim. And Rashi explains, because you need Levim straight away, from day one. So it is clear that the Ramban has taken a different path. He understands that this happened in Chodesh Iyar. But the question remains, so what happened during that month? Says Reb Leib Hyman Zatzal in the Sefer Chikrei Lev, should we ask the question, who did the Levim's job in the month before the Levim were prepared to do their Avodah? The answer, it seems, is the Levim. And the reason why is because Levim, because they are already prepared. They are already equipped and qualified to do the Avodah. Now, how so? And by virtue of what? After all, they haven't yet had their process as described in Bamidbar Perek Ches. Says the Chikrei Lev, the answer to this question is to be found in the Ramban. If we look later on in Parshas Ekev, which is one of those summer parshas, so it doesn't deserve the scrutiny that it get the scrutiny it deserves, but the Pasuk states in Perek Yud Pasuk Ches of Devarim, Bo'esahi hivdil Hashem es Shevet Levi laseis es Aron bris Hashem. At that time, yet to be defined, but at that time, Hashem separated Shevet Levi to carry the Aron la'amod lefnei Hashem l'sharso u'levarech b'shmo ad hayom hazeh. So the Pasuk in Devarim is describing the separation of Shevet Levi, setting them aside for the Avodah, at a time called Ba'es Hahi, at that time. Our question, of course, is, when is that time? We will be keen to try and find out. Well, says Ramban, if you look at the preceding psukim in Parshas Ekev there, you will see that they are a reference and a description of the Chet HaEgel. Which means somehow, having described the Chet HaEgel at quite some length, and the Pasuk goes on to say, Ba'es Hahi, we are to understand that the reference is to that time. The Levim were separated at the time of the Egel. Now, do we see this? It happens to be that we do. There are words that are spoken by Moshe Rabbeinu in Parshas Kisisa at the time of the Egel that we need to pay full attention to now. Moshe stands and says, Mila Shem Eli, Vayasfu Elav Ko B'nei Levi, and Levi's ready. Now we know what happened. They were the ones who executed everyone who was involved in the Egel. Moshe charges them as follows. Vayome Moshe, this is in Shmos Perik Lamed Beis, Pasuk Kaftes. Mil'u Yedchem Hayom Lashem. Now, to translate those words literally will not help us at all. Literally, fill your hands today for Hashem. Mil'u yedchem hayom l'Hashem. What is the meaning of that? Says Rashi, the concept of milu yadayim, of filling one's hands, represents a person becoming qualified to take up a certain position. when the Kohanim assume their status of Kahuna, in Parshas Tetzaveh, it says, Asher Yimalei Es Yadav Lechahein. So the concept of Milu Yadayim is to become qualified to attain a certain status, a certain position. If that's true, then Moshe Rabbeinu seems to be saying to the Levim that with what they're about to do, it's not merely, and again, quote unquote, merely doing the right thing, but rather they, through this, they will attain a certain status that they didn't have before. And the truth is, everything that we have just said is explicit in the words of Rashi, commenting on Mil'u Yedchem, says Rashi, Atem Hahorgim Osam, you who are dispensing justice to the people who were involved in the Egel, Bidavar ze titchanchu lihios kohanim lamokam. Through this you will be mitchanech. This is your inauguration into kahuna in the broader sense, that is to say, this is where the Levium became Levium. So that's very interesting. It is an aspect of what happened on that occasion that is often overlooked. Not only did they do the right thing, but thereby that is where how they became Levium. And this, says Ramban, is the understanding of the pasuk we mentioned before in Parshas Eked. Ba'es hahi hivdil Hashem es shevet Levi. At that time. When is that time? At the time of the Egel. And through what? As the pasuk says, Mil'u yedchem hayom Lashem. And therefore, says the Chikrei Lev, should you ask who was to do the avoda of the Levium during the first month of the Mishkan, who was qualified? The answer is the Levium. They've been qualified for months. They've been qualified, Minu Yadayim, from the time of the Egel. They're ready to go. And that is the answer to that question. The problem is, it's such a good answer, it actually makes things worse than they ever were. Because if indeed it's true that the Milu Yadayim, the inauguration, and the attaining of the status of Levium happened at the time of the Egel, so what are we to make of Parshas Ba'alosecha, which says, take Shevet Levi, and purify them, and separate them, and ready them. They're ready already. Why do they need to be prepared for something that they are already prepared? It says the Chikrei Lev, a fascinating insight. At the time of the Egel, the Levium attained a certain elevated status. That did not exist in a vacuum. That is to say, the status, or there was a group of people who had the Avodah in their domain, who lost it at that time, and it was picked up by the Levium. That group of people are the Bechorim. As we know, it's one of the difficult episodes for Bechorim, but they lost the Bechorim at that time. Prior to the Chet HaEgel, the Avodah was with the Bechorim, and then, as they forfeited it, it was picked up by the Levium. Now, says Chikrei Lev, something very interesting. If you pick up something from someone, you don't have more than what you picked up. If the Avodah originally rested with the Bechorim, and then they lost it, and then the Levium picked it up, the Levium naturally do not have more than what they took from the Bechorim. And what do we mean to say by this? The Bechorim did the Avodah. But the Bechorim did not bequeath and pass over the Avodah, did not pass it down to all of their children as a matter of course. After all, as much as there's one can try and attain the Kahuna because his father was a Kohen, if you've heard the story, you cannot say, I would like to perform the Avodah because my father was a Bechor. Because the question that you have to be prepared to answer is, are you a Bechor? And if the answer is no, then the fact that you are descended from a Bechor is meaningless. If that's true, we may posit that the Avodah as picked up at the time of the Egel was good for the Levium. Each person stepped in to assume the Avodah. But what about his children? Will they all be Levium in the sense of having the Avodah Salavim? It doesn't seem so. The conservation of matter doesn't allow for it at this stage. It is to this end, says Chikrei Lev, that there is a further installment and a further development within the consecration and the inauguration of the Levium. Namely, they themselves as individuals already have the Avodah. Through this process, it will be with them and their families for all time. And what's interesting is, this approach will shed new light on comments which otherwise perhaps we may not fully absorb their impact. Pasuk Yudalet states, moving back to Perek Ches, Pasuk Yudalet, V'hibdalto es ha-Levi'im mitoch b'nei Yisrael. Separate the Levi'im from b'nei Yisrael. V'hoyu li ha-Levi'im. And the Levi'im will be to me, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we have, in a sense, two sections of this Pasuk. Separate the Levi'im and they will be for me. Is this two ways of saying the same thing? The Sforno comments on the first half of the Pasuk Yudalet, V'hivdal Torah Salavim mitoch b'nei Yisrael, separate the Levi'im, says the Sforno, Tavdil es ha-Levi'im asher heim chayim adena. It is a reference to Levi'im who are alive now. The final phrase of the Pasuk, the Hoyu li ha-Levi'im, and the Levi'im will thereby be to me, says the Sforno, heim v'zar'am yunachonim labodoso, them and their children. In other words, the impact of this stage of the process is not only the Levi'im themselves who are here, but also for future generations. And as far as the Chikrei Lev is concerned, that is the entire purpose of this second wave of inauguration. And moreover, again, we find this reverberation in Pasuk Tetzayin, states, Ki nesunim, nesunim, heima li. Nesunim, nesunim, given over, given over. And everyone, of course, comments, what is the double expression, nesunim, nesunim? The Ibn Ezra states, nesunim, nesunim, given over, heim uvenehem. They are given over, and now their children are given over. So this is a very interesting analysis of this section of Baal Osecha to understand exactly what yet had to happen even after the Levi'im had seemingly attained their status fully at the time of the Egel itself. Now, I'd like to devote at this point some attention to probably one of the most famous features of Parshas Baal Osecha, and that is at the beginning. Well, the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, more correctly, the very end of Perek Yud, Pasuk Lamed He and Pasuk Lamed Vav. And these are psukim that, of course, need no introduction. Vayihi ben Sova Ha'aron, Vayomer Moshe, Kum Hashem V'yafutzu Evecha, and then Uvenucha Yomar, Shuv Hashem, Rivavos Alfei Yisrael. These are psukim that we say when we take the Sefer Torah out and when we put the Sefer Torah back. Of course, we cannot help but notice that there's something slightly unusual about this section, namely the brackets before and afterwards. The nun before Vayihi ben Soa and the nun after Rivavos Alfei Yisrael. What are they there for? What are they doing? Rashi comments. Asalo simonios, milafonov umilaacharov. The Torah has placed a signal, a signpost, before these two psukim and afterwards. Lomar, she'ein zemakomo. You need to know this is not the natural setting, the natural context of these two psukim. They should really be somewhere else. So, of course, if they should be somewhere else, and why are they here? V'lama nichtav kan, why were they written here? Kedei lahafsik bein pur'onus l'pur'onus. In order to divide, to wedge between and prize apart two disasters. And Rashi's source is in the Talmud in Masechet Shabbos, daf kuftes vav. So before these psukim, we have a disaster which needs to be identified. After these psukim, we have a string of disasters which do not need to be identified. And in between, we have these two psukim of Vayihi ben Sora And it's unique. Never before and never again in the Torah is there such a thing where it has been implanted between them in order to drive them apart, and the Torah lets you know it by placing these two markers before and afterwards as signposts that this is not the natural setting. Of course, we will be curious as to, of all the letters in the Aleph Beis that could be chosen, why the Nun? Interestingly, the Marshal in the Tshuva is of the opinion that the Nuns that are to be written backwards are not an extra Nun before the Psukim and afterwards, but rather the Nun of the first Pasuk and the Nun of the second Pasuk. Vayi bin Soa, the Nun of the word bin Soa, as far as the Marshal understands, that's the signpost, and then the Nun of Uvenucho Yomar. However, the Nun of Yehuda writes at length to defend and explain certainly what is the practice in every Sefer Torah that we have, that there really are Nuns before and afterwards. So for us, conveniently but unhelpfully, we see these Nuns as very similar to a bracket, and therefore we're not inclined to suggest any other letter should be the case, but of course that will only take us so far. So in looking to understand why it is that the Torah chose the letter Nun to bracket this section, and there are a number of very interesting explanations. The Maskil of David, Rabbi David Pardo, in his Perush on Rashi here, explains that the answer is to be found in a well-known section of the Talmud in Maseches Brachos, in Daf Dalad Amud Beis, which discusses Ashrei. And it speaks about in praise of one who says Ashrei and in praise of Ashrei. And in the course of that discussion, the Talmud notes that, of course, Ashrei is famous for going according to the Seder of the Aleph Beis, and that has every single letter, with the exception of the letter Nun. There is no Nun. There's Malchus, Malchus, and then straight to Somech. Where's the Nun? Im Kvar, as they say. If you're following the Seder of the Aleph Beis, so you've got to follow the Seder. And the answer of the Gemara, rather cryptically, is that Nun is not a letter that augurs well for the Jewish people, and therefore it is absent from Ashrei. Mipnei sheyesh bo mapaloson shel sonei Yisrael. It has with it the connotation of nefila. And we don't want to talk about falling when we're in such a fantastic setting as Ashrei. Now, of course, as Mefarshim point out, the Rashba and the Tshuvas, if you've read Megillas Eicha recently, you will know that pretty much any letter of the Aleph Beis can spell disaster, as surely as it can spell prosperity. And therefore the question will still remain, of all of the letters that can have a negative connotation, why is it that specifically the Nun, because of the Nefila implications, was missed out? That said, says the Gemara, David HaMelech nonetheless did refer to it, for the next pasuk is Somech Hashem L'chol HaNoflim. It is an oblique reference to the Nefila that was missed out. Hashem supports those that fall. But no overt reference to falling. So Nun is the anti-letter of Ashrei. And therefore says the Maskil of David, Ashrei. Therefore says Maskil of David, should we wonder why is it that of all of the letters, the one that comes before and after Vayib and Soa is a Nun, it's because the nature of the things that it is prizing apart are Nefilos, their calamity, their pro'onus. And therefore the Torah says Nun, Nun, meaning there's a Nefila here, Nefila here, and that's why you have these psukim in between. So that's the Maskil of David based on the Gemara and Brachos and Daf Dalet. Rabbeinu Bachya has a totally different interpretation. And he raises a question that perhaps we may not have been inclined to ask. We know that these two psukim, this is not really where they should be. This is not naturally where they would be. Well, where would they naturally be? Where is the correct location, quote unquote? Well, actually, Rashi comments. Rashi in Maseches Shabbos, Daf Kuftes Vav, explains that the very first time you see a reference to the Jewish people traveling, which is in Parshas Bamidbar, when it says firstly that the camp of Yehuda would travel. Then the camp of Reuven would travel. And then it says that the Oel Moed would travel. That's where it should have said, Vayhi ben Soa Ha'aron. That's the first reference you have in Chumash Bamidbar to the Aron traveling. Specifically, it's in Bamidbar, Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Okay, now we know. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, we know that when the Torah, when we talk about Parshas in the halachic sense, it's not Parshat Shavua, but it's Parshas in the sense of paragraphs. And there are two ways that the Torah can have a paragraph. Either that the when it finishes the paragraph, the rest of the line is left blank, that's called a Ptucha, or the next paragraph begins on the same line, that's called a Stuma. But they're both paragraphs. If you note, says Rabbeinu Bachya, you will see that the correct placing of these parshas, of these psukim, Vayhi ben Soa, is exactly 50 parshas earlier than where it features in the Torah. It's in Baal Losecha in the beginning, at the end of Perek Yud. It should be in Perek Beis. That is exactly 50 parshas back. And in order to denote this, the Torah puts a nun facing backwards. It's a fascinating signpost because what it's saying is, this is not where it's meant to be. If you want to know where it is meant to be, nun backwards. Go back 50, etc., and so forth. Perek Beis Pasuk Yud Zayin. Perek Beis Pasuk Yud Zayin. A third approach, which is to be found in the Sefer Meyamlo Eiz for Rabbi Yaakov Kuli, to get a sense of the characterization of these Puranas. We don't like to talk about them, but we have to learn from them. Both of them, and they have yet to be defined, but we know where we are. There's the misown in them, and there are other things. They are, each one in their own way, a step backwards, or a step downwards from the level that the Jewish people had attained at Har Sinai. At Har Sinai, there was a positive atmosphere, positive setting, everything was as it should be, and as they moved away, certain things began to disassemble. And it was a reversal of the attainments of Har Sinai. And interestingly, as the Mefarshim point out, the first of the Peronos, Vayisu Mehar Hashem, they traveled away from Har Sinai. That's what comes immediately before Vayhi ben Soa. And that's disaster number one. Now you get the impression that they left of their own accord. That is actually not true. The Pasuk described in great detail how they could never travel unless the Anan of Hashem picked up and moved forward. That's when they know to go. And that exactly is what happened here. So that being the case, one has to wonder, when the Pasuk says, Vayisu Mehar Hashem, what did they do wrong? On the contrary, if they would have stayed there, that would have been wrong. Because they're receiving a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to move on. So if they're told to move on, and they move on, why is that a disaster? They had no choice. It was the right thing to do. But the Mefarshim explain, in an instant like this, it has never been truer to say, it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. They have to leave. But how do they leave? That, the difference is decisive. The characterization that Chazal give of ketino kabareach mibeis ha-sefer, of a child as he leaves school. If you're ever in one of those locations where children leave school, it's a stampede. It's a public hazard. One best stays indoors until it passes. And that's the characterization. And it's very subtle, but it is decisive. To leave, you have to leave. But to leave Har Hashem, say the Mefarshim, you shouldn't leave Har Hashem without taking it with you. To leave it behind, that's a disaster. And actually, that represented, therefore, a relinquishing and a forfeiting of much of what we'd gained at Har Sinai. And of course, our attainments at Har Sinai are best summed up with our finest hour, Na'aseh V'Nishma. Na'aseh V'Nishma says everything about the way the Jewish people should be. A reversal of Na'aseh V'Nishma is really what characterized the disasters as we left Har Hashem. And that's why the brackets that really characterize this section are two nuns and they're backwards. They correspond to the reversal of Nase and the reversal of Nishma. So these are very sobering ideas. Of course, we're in an unpleasant section of the Torah. But at this point, we need to ask, what are the Puranas? So far we've spoken in vague terms. Lahafrid ben Puranas le Puranas. What are the two calamities? And really the background to the question is that these two psukim feature at the end of Perek Yud. At the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, that is to say, post these psukim, you have what looks like two Puranas. The opening psukim of Perek Yud Aleph is the section of the Misonanim, Vayiyam Kemisonanim, which is the first three psukim. And then you have at length, from Pasuk Dalet until further notice, to the end of the Perek, you have what's called Kivro Satava. His avutava, and they rebelled, and they wanted meat, and it seemed like they didn't want anything else. And they suffered for it, and that's also Puranas. And therefore, we really need to reckon with an understanding of what are the Puranas that we're looking to divide between, given that the Torah seems to have gone to great lengths to price apart two Puranas, and then put two Puranas right next to each other. First the Misonanim, and then straight afterwards, Kivra Satava. And both of them are following from Vayibin Sohar Aaron. That's the question that needs to be addressed. And in fact, Nechleku Rishonim. We find Rishonim differ on this matter. The Tosfos in Maseches Shabbos are of the opinion that really there are two Puranas. One before and one afterwards. The one before, as we said, is Vayis'u Mehar Hashem. Ketino Kavareach Mebeis HaSefer. That was calamity number one. And then comes the wall, the dividing wall. And then you have the section of the Misonanim. And following that, you have Kivra Satava. But Tosfos are of the opinion that Kivra Satava, in a sense, is a continuation of the episode of the Misonanim. It began with Misonanim and then became Kivra Satava. Variations on a theme. But that is all the second Puranas. That's quite a thing to say. But for Tosfos, Vayi ben Soar very much is in between the two Puranas. Rashi, in Maseches Shabbos there, has a rather startling interpretation. For Rashi, the second Puranas, as we've seen, is what comes straight after these psukim, Vayehi ha'am kemisonanim. That's Puranas number two. And what is Puranas number one? Says Rashi, Kivro Satava. Now, that needs to be understood. Puranas number one is meant to come before the Psukim of Vayi ben Soar. Kivro Satava is written afterwards. What does Rashi mean to say by this? And why does he explain this way? Well, Maharal, coming to explain Rashi's words, says that it's clear to Rashi, Kivra Satava must somehow have already been happening before the section of Vayi ben Soar. For the very simple reason that if it wasn't, then you haven't divided between two Puranas, because you have the Misonanim, and straight afterwards Kivra Satava. If the Torah has divided between them, it must be that at least at a root level, as they left Har Sinai, you have the beginnings of Kivra Satava. That which will be described at great length afterwards is already rooted in before. Which means, to be very clear, as we take stock of Rashi's position, for Rashi as well, there are two Puranas. The first one to happen is the last one to be discussed at length, namely Kivra Satava, rooted in Vayis'u Mehar Hashem, which is mentioned before these two psukim. And then number two is Vayihi Ha'am Kimisonanim. And what's very interesting is, number one, we should note that for Rashi, it is more important that the Torah divided these calamities at their root, meaning as they left Har Sinai, it was the beginnings of Kivra Satava. That's the place to put the dividing wall. Everything beyond that is an emanation. It's just, it's playing itself out. But it has to be divided at the root. And secondly, as the Mizrahi points out, Rashi here is consistent with an idea that he has in Lashon HaKodesh. Namely, we know that there are two ways that the Torah can describe an event in the past. Most common, actually, is with the Vav HaHipuch, the Vav conversive. Vayidaber, Vayihi, which essentially means something happened in the past. Of course, it is possible to use the past tense itself instead of Vayidaber to say Diber, instead of Vayihi to say Haya. Is there a difference between those two words, or are they two ways of saying the same thing? Rashi is on record as early on as Parshas Bereishis as saying that these are not the same thing at all. When the Torah uses the Vav HaHipuch to denote the past, it means, and then this happened. And then this other thing happened. But when the Torah uses the past tense by itself, it refers to what we would call in English the past perfect, or the pluperfect. That is to say, not that this happened, but this had already happened. And therefore, says the Mizrahi, compare the way the Torah describes the two calamities of Misonanim and Kibros HaTava. In Misonanim, it says in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, Vayehi ha'am k'misonanim. That's the Vav HaHipuch, meaning, and then this happened. But when it comes to Kibros HaTava, in Pasuk Dalet, it says, V'ho'asav sufa shebi kirbo, his'avu ta'ava. That is a pure perfect. It does not say Vayis'avu, and then this happened. His'avu itself denotes this was already happening, which is confirmation of what Rashi is telling us, that the Kibros HaTava has already begun before any of this in Vayisu Mehar Hashem. So far we have two explanations as to what the two Puranos could be. And of course, how many other explanations could there be? If there's only two of them. The answer is, says Ramban, there were three of them. What seems to us to be three separate sections, as far as the Ramban is concerned, unlike Rashi and like Tosfos, we may add, are actually three separate Puranos. Now, and in order, Vayis'u Me'ar Hashem is number one, and that was already a Puranos. Ketino Kabrech Beis HaSefer. Number two is Misonanim, and number three is Kivros HaTava. Now you'll say to me, says Ramban, well, what did you help? You brought in a dividing wall, and still you have two together. Says Ramban, two Puranos together is not that bad. That is to say, what the Torah is wishing to avoid is not two Puranas together, but three Puranas together. Because whenever you have three of anything together, it constitutes that which is called a chazokah, a pattern, and a pattern of Puranas. Puranas happen, and they happened. What the Torah is looking to avoid is presenting them as a chazokah of Puranas, because then that means Puranas is the tone that is set until further notice. So this is the approach of Ramban. It's enough that the Torah has prized apart one and two, and even if two and three are together, but a chazokah you don't have. And what's fascinating is, as is pointed out by a number of Mefarshim, the Marsham in his Perush Tchelas Mordechai and the Ramban, and also the Chasam Sofer in his Perush on the Torah, that this may give us further insight into this matter. Because the question of what to make of the nuns on either side, of the containment and the isolation of these two psukim, is actually a machlokas in the Gemara. There are two approaches in the Gemara as to how to explain the Torah sectioning off these two psukim. Rashi has quoted one of them. It happens to be the opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. But the second opinion, and if you've never heard this before, it will be quite a surprise, the second opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, is that the Torah has placed markers on either side of these two psukim in order to let you know that they have the status of a sefer in their own right. They are sefer b'pnei atzmon. It is without a doubt the shortest sefer in the entire Tanakh. And that's it. And he bases himself, as far as Rebbe is concerned, nothing is out of order. Everything is exactly in order. The reason why the Torah has given such signposts on either side is because if you didn't have it, you'd think that I'm reading two psukim from the same sefer. You don't realize you've finished a sefer at the end of Perek Yud. And now you're in a second sefer. And when you finish these two psukim, we'll begin a third sefer. All told, as far as Rebbe is concerned, Bamidbar is divided into three, which actually gives us a total of seven sforim. It's such a chiddush, it's impossible even to know how to define it. It's not even accurate anymore to say that Rebbe holds there are seven chumashim, because they're not even chumashim anymore. They're not seven-fifths, they're seven-sevenths. But Rebbe Yehuda Nasi bases his approach on the pasuk in Mishle, Chotzva Amudeha Shiva. HaKadosh Baruch Hu hewed out the seven pillars of the world, says Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. They are the seven sforim of the Torah. And we should know. Not only do we have this rather esoteric sounding machlokas, what are we to make of these two nuns that bracket these two psukim? Is it because they've been inserted somewhere else? Or maybe they're a sefer in their own right. There are halachic ramifications for this machlokas. As we know, when something is a sefer, it has certain halachas that pertain to it. There is the covet of a sefer, and it has many unique halachas that accrue to a sefer. Now, we know that if you have a sefer, imagine that a letter was erased from the sefer. What will we say? It's no longer a sefer. That's not true. It's a sefer, but it's missing a letter. If all of the letters were erased, you could no longer say it's a sefer without any letters, because that's just tripping over words. It's not a sefer, it doesn't say anything. So clearly, between missing one and missing all, there's got to be a dividing point whereby we say it's missing letters, but it's still a sefer. It's a sefer that's missing letters. When is that point? What is the lowest threshold of number of letters that can be in a sefer, and it's still called a sefer, with all of the halachas that go with it? It says the Rambam in Hilchas Sefer Torah, 85. I mean, if you asked, that's the answer. Why? Pei Hei Osios. Where does that come from? Says the Rambam, because that is the number of letters in the shortest sefer in the Tanakh, namely in the two psukim of Vayehi Ben Soa and Venucho Yomar. Now, of course, we immediately note that that is only halachically valid if you view these two psukim as a sefer, which is actually only true according to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who disputes him, doesn't see this as their own sefer. They're two psukim from elsewhere in the sefer that have been inserted here artificially. And therefore we see that this is not only a question of how to understand the sequence of psukim, but it will have halachic ramifications. And amazingly, the Rambam has paskan like Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi here. Now, what we do see is a very fundamental dispute as to what to make of these nuns. What are they? Are they telling you this is not the natural setting? Are they marking it as a sefer in its own right? What's the background to this dispute, if we may ask? Says the Chasam Sofer, there exists a concept called chazaka. Chazaka is establishing a pattern. That is to say, as we know, whenever one looks at any evidence or occurrences, at a certain point you will stop looking at things as isolated incidents and begin to look upon them as establishing a pattern. When is that point? If something happens once, I mean, pretty much anything can happen once, that doesn't necessarily mean it will happen again. We would say, to use the term advisedly, mikrehu, it happens. Does that mean it will happen again? Not necessarily. If it is repeated, that's already an indication that perhaps it will repeat itself again. And that's really the idea of what we call a chazaka in the active sense. The question is, how many times does it need to happen in order for us to say, this is no longer mikre, this is a pattern, or this is a chazaka? How many times? Well, we know the answer is three times. Once it's happened three times, then it's the chazaka. However, as is often the case, that is not a unanimous view. The matter happens to be disputed in the Talmud, in Maseches Yevamos, Daf Samach Dalet, Amud Beis, between none other than Rebbe and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the very same two people who are disputing what to make of the nuns around Vayhi ben Soa. As far as Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is concerned, three times represents a chazaka. Rebbe argues and says twice, anything that happens and happens again, beware. It is, you no longer look upon it as merely a mikra. Says Chassam Sofer, and now that we have a broader sense of the viewpoints here, we'll understand more of the background as to how they approach the two nuns around Vayhi ben Soa. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, the reason why the Torah put two nuns around it is to tell you, this is not its natural setting. It's been brought in here in order to prize apart Peronos. Our question was, well, you may have prized apart one and two, but there's another Peronos afterwards. You have, after these two Pesukim, you have Misonanim and Kivras Atava. You didn't prize them apart. Says Ramban, it's okay. Even though, in Ramban's analysis, there are three, but as long as the three are not together, there's no chazaka. Says Chassam Sofer, that is true specifically for Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Because Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is of the opinion that three constitutes chazaka. So if you can break between any of the three, you have no chazaka. But it's not going to help Rebbe. Because Rebbe holds the two are a chazaka. Which means if you have three in a row, and you divide it between one and two, it still won't stop the chazaka, because between two and three there's nothing dividing. And two alone is enough to establish a chazaka as far as Rebbe. And therefore, as they say in the classics, Lishitoso, consistent with his opinion as to what constitutes chazaka, Rebbe takes a dramatically different view of this entire bracketing of the nuns. It can't be to separate them, because it doesn't help. You separate one and two, but two and three are together, you didn't help. That's why Rebbe is of the opinion that something else entirely is going on here, namely that the Torah is marking them off as a sefer on their own. So this is a classic insight from the Chassam Sofer. Of course, as is always the case, the more you know, the more you understand what's in front of you, but often it helps to have someone like the Chassam Sofer to give us a hand. What we do see is that the Torah took steps to prize apart two sections of disaster. And now the question is, what did it help, if we may ask? In other words, following the path of Rashi, and this is the only explanation that he quotes, it's from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Two things happened, one after the other, whatever they may be. Vayisu mehar Hashem, and then Misonanim. The Torah doesn't want them together. Torah doesn't want the Peronos together. So, it brings in a Pasuk to divide between them. Ask the Mefarshim, so now there's a Pasuk that divides between them, so they didn't happen together? I mean, they did. So as much as you may put something else in the middle, it doesn't mean it was in the middle. And it also doesn't mean that the Torah means to say it was in the middle. The Torah pains to point out that this didn't really happen here. So in any case, you gave it away. Two things happened one after the other. The Torah says we're going to put something in between, even though this didn't really happen there. Because really, they did happen one after the other. So what have we gained? Except what the Torah is looking to establish here is that indeed, we should not be deceived. This is where the Torah reveals to us the nature of the Jewish people. It could be, if we didn't know better, we would take the fact that we had one disaster, and then straight afterwards we had another disaster, and maybe even a third disaster, and what the moral of the story is, we're a disaster. That is to say, we are prone to calamity. It's the nature of the Jewish people. That's really what a chazaka is, whether it's two or three. But the notion is when something repeats itself, it's symptomatic of something that's embedded within the essence of the person or people. That would be our conclusion. And that is wrong. That is false. On this occasion, the Torah says, as true as it is, Disaster follows swiftly, one after the other. Do not make a mistake. Here the Torah reveals the nature of the Jewish people. It is not in their nature to sin. If they sin three times, one after the other, they may have been disoriented, they may have been confused, they may have been somewhat impetuous or otherwise ill-advised in the way that they went about things. Do not assess the series, as you will see in front of you, the way you otherwise would, because that is a mistake. So it's very interesting, because should we ask the question, is it true, is it MS to put something else in between? The answer is historically no, and the Torah never means it historically. It goes out of its way to tell you this is not historically when it happened. But it is true essentially, because on the contrary, it saves you from a mistruth. If you did not have something put in between these, you would make a mistake about the Jewish people, and a mistake is not true. So in order to have a correct understanding, as difficult as problematic as these episodes were, they were exactly that, episodes, but they do not reflect the nature of the Jewish people, and that truth comes out by the Torah going out of its way to put something in between what otherwise would have been mistaken for a pattern. What we do see is, and this is in a sense one of the most astounding lessons, the first Poronos, certainly for Tosfos and the Ramban and what seems to be the simple understanding, the first Poronos of Vayisu Me'ar Hashem, and we raised the question before. So they traveled. They were told to travel. What will you say? But it's the way that you travel. They traveled without due regard for the Torah that they'd received at Har Sinai. They left it a little bit behind. So now let's ask a question. Is that correct? No. But if we were asked, would we define that as a calamity? I don't know we'd go that far. A calamity is a strong word. Numbers 2 and 3, or number 2, part A and B, of Misonanim and of Kivras HaTava, I mean, they were undeniably calamitous. They were absolute disasters. But should you be asked, would you place on a par with those two the fact that when we left, so that on the Torah's meter, the Jewish people had just a little bit too much bounce in their step as they left Har Sinai. Not sufficient regard for the Torah that they learned there. Would you consider that to be a disaster on a par with Misonanim and Kibras HaTava? I don't think we would have ever have said that. But along comes the Torah and says, no, it is a disaster. Not only is it a disaster, it is such a disaster that it is worthwhile the Torah doing something that it has never done before and will never do again. Importing a pasuk and dropping it in between this and what's to come so that you shouldn't have two disasters together. That's how big of a disaster it is. And the truth is that the more we ponder it, the more we understand why. From a certain point of view, what is it that stands a person in instead? What is it that fortifies a person to withstand everything that life and the journey has to offer? It's their connection with Torah. It's their connection to the higher calling that the Torah has for them. If a person does not have sufficient regard, so I don't think it's an overstatement to say that everything else is more or less waiting to happen. If a person does not have their connection to Har Sinai, if they left behind the Na'aseh v'Nishma, if they turned them around and left two nuns on the way out from Har Sinai, so one shouldn't be surprised if there's Misonanim and there's Kivras HaTava, because that's what life looks like in the Midbar without a person who's connected to Sinai. And therefore, once again, we see, and it was true for Bnei Yisrael, and we are Bnei Yisrael, and it's true for us. And I'm not sure that the things that we have to face are any different in their way for the vicissitudes of life in the Midbar. And there are setbacks and Misonanim and Kivras HaTava and everything that we encounter during life. The way that we navigate it will be a function of the extent to which we've taken the two nuns from Har Sinai, and as we travel from our learning back out into the world, if we take that with us, so Mitzvah Hashem, that is what vouchsafes us to be able to avoid things like Misonanim, like Kivras HaTava, and to be aware of just how great a disaster it is not to do that. The Torah says, here's a section, be fully aware it didn't exist here because the Poronos has just happened. And the lesson for us Ladoros is that the Poronos to be avoided as we make our way through life. leave it over there for this evening.